If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, September the 3rd, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. Joining me today here in our recording studio in the campus of Stanford University is Dr. Timothy Kane, an economist and Hoover Institution's J.P. Conte Fellow in Immigration Studies. We're going to get to immigration a little later in the podcast, but first we're going to talk economics. And Tim, I want to congratulate you. You are falling down a path started by one Donald Trump, who famously at one point owned the Miss Universe franchise. He was in the business of beauty contests. And you saw running a beauty contest, so it is an economic beauty contest.
You've seen right through me, Bill, again.
I read through like a cheap suit. Explain to our listeners what is exactly economic beauty contest, how you came up with this idea, and more to the point, how they can get involved.
You know, I was at a luncheon here at beautiful Stanford University with our colleagues here at Hoover, and we were having a debate about inequality, and one of my economics colleagues said, even with all this income inequality, why are you so frustrated, Tim? And I said, well, there are things that we value that we just don't measure using income. So when you tell me that the poor are as poor today as they were 100 years ago, which some non-Hoover economists have said, yeah, I think that's baloney. My mom and dad didn't have air conditioning, and when they bought it, even though now the cost of air conditioning's really small, that's worth more than the price in the market. So this sounds funny for a capitalist economist to say, right? But I wanted to come up with a way to go about that. And so another colleague said, this reminds me of John Maynard Keynes' beauty contest that he wrote about in his magnum opus, The General Theory. And this was a British contest in the newspapers where they'd have totally politically incorrectly 60 pretty faces, girls' faces. Mm-hmm. And if you could guess the six prettiest, then you won, you know, some prize. Well, the six prettiest was just the average of what all the other people thought were the prettiest.
Right.
And so Keynes said, you're not really guessing at the prettiest faces. You're guessing what other people think, other people think, other people think,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. Well, how do we then apply that to how much is air conditioning worth? And that's where my mom has literally said, I would have to pay her $8 million to give up air conditioning. I think the median American would say, you know, yeah, it probably worth $10,000, $15,000. That's a lot more than we pay for. So that's how it all started.
Right. Okay. So I took the quiz.
You did?
Yeah. Well, actually, tell listeners where they can. So the quiz is open today. It's Tuesday the 3rd.
Yep.
The quiz is open through Monday of next week.
We are going to have the quiz open if you want to get in it. Mm-hmm. And you can be one of the 100 most insightful people in America. Mm-hmm. You need to get your response in before September 9th.
Right.
At midnight. Now, those 100 people that are the most insightful will win $100. So we're going to give away $10,000 in prizes if you can help me understand value. Pretty simple.
Okay. Have you taken the quiz?
Oh, well, I've taken it many times just to make sure it's working.
Uh-huh.
So the website's smooth and working.
I have, too. I'm curious as to what you learned about yourself from taking it, because I learned a few things about myself from taking it.
You know, I do always try to take it seriously, mm-hmm. and you know, we can't give away too much.
Right.
But maybe we could make up a question. So we do a bit of a beauty contest where we have 9 beautiful photos. Mm-hmm. And they're not women. They're all sorts of other things, nature and stars. What's different is when something I think is beautiful, and then I ask the question, what do other people think is beautiful? I actually do give different responses.
Right.
But my notion of what other people thinks is beautiful, I've realized it changes sometimes from day to day, and I don't know why. Maybe I saw a movie. Maybe I went through a national park, and it evokes those memories. But probably it is hard to pin down dollar value sometimes.
Yeah, I bogged down on that one, too, because I looked at, not to give this away too much, but there you look at a screen and there's an option of different images, and you have to decide what is beautiful to you. And some be very pretty nature scenes, and so I kind of thought what I looked pretty. And then comes the question, what do you think other people will think is pretty?
Right.
And I had to kind of put myself into sort of like gift card mode. There's a, when I get my car wash, for example, there's a great little gift shop in it, and they have all kinds of cards. I had to think, okay, what would sell here?
Yeah.
So that, but what struck me as interesting, Tim, was when you get to the part of the quiz where you're asked to put a price on things.
Yeah.
For example, doing without your cell phone, doing without your laptop, things like that. I could not put a price on going for a year without my laptop.
Yeah. Just here's the thing, mm-hmm. the intranet that was invented in 1994. Mm-hmm. I mean, let me say commercialized. And, you know, could you put your phone down, your smartphone in the internet for the 3-day weekend we just had?
I'll tell you a funny anecdote. I went to a movie the other week with a friend, and I went to the restroom after the movie and left my phone with my friend when I went to the restroom. And when I walked out of the restroom for a split second, I forgot that I'd given her the phone. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so for 30 seconds of just pure naked terror, I thought I'd lost my cell phone.
It's the worst.
And just not having your cell phone on you, not having that connected to you, you feel very isolated all of
a
sudden.
Yeah. You know, my mom, I'm going to diverge into a personal story. Mm-hmm. My mom raised us to never feel sorry for ourselves, even though we didn't have a lot of money. Don't. And she also said, don't take things for granted. Just live a positive life and appreciate what you have. Maybe you don't have air conditioning, but we had a fan, right? Mm-hmm. So that was nice. But growing up that way, when I got things like air conditioning, microwave, cable TV, I can't stop myself, Bill. I take things for granted. It's only until they're taken away from you after you're used to having them do you realize, boy, that meant a lot to me.
You know, something else I discovered, Tim, living in California as I have now for the past 25 years, it's gotten to me. Hmm. And it's gotten to me when it came time to put a price on an automobile, how much you'd be willing to pay for an automobile, how much you'd be willing to pay for a refrigerator.
Yeah.
And I'd like to ask you this as an economist. When you're asked to put a dollar sign on an automobile, let's say, the question is how much you'd be willing to pay. Are you influenced economically by the culture you live in? Because here we are sitting in Palo Alto, California, and if you're doing well in Palo Alto, California, and you're keeping up with the Joneses have $80,000 to $100,000 Mercedes SUVs mm-hmm. and Teslas and Range Rovers and things like that. So you might put down $80,000 is what you're willing to pay for a car because that's what the market bears. On the other hand, if we're sitting in the Midwestern in the Ohio district where you ran for Congress, $80,000 for a car?
It's insane.
That'd be the end of candidate Kane.
It's insane.
So is this a product of individual's taste, or is it really, are you economically influenced by the milieu in which
you're absolutely. There is some relativism to your preferences, but there's some absolutism too. Mm-hmm. And the prices on things, even though I know the price of a dollar is not the same that it used to be, to buy a vehicle for me, and I'm of a certain age here, as are you, to buy a vehicle for a dollar price tag that's more than my parents' house when they bought it, that's hard for me. And I think that for me, that's the $30,000 range. So you could buy houses, and I mean, you still can, but a good house was $30,000 when I was growing up. And now that's a pretty standard sports utility vehicle.
The first home my parents bought in Arlington, Virginia, I think, for $12,500.
Oh, yeah. So it's sometimes hard for me, and it actually does check me a little bit. Mm-hmm. Should I be spending this much money now?
Right.
Because whatever I don't spend, I'm saving. Here's what's fun, though. So a lot of people have followed this phrase called behavioral economics, and the core insight of some economists is that they did experiments in laboratories where people would pay one price to buy a mug, mm-hmm. but they demanded a much higher price if they were going to sell that exact same mug. And so people who aren't economists go, aha, the myth of rationality. There's no such thing. People are irrational. And this research points out they're not, because when I go to buy something, I'm sorry, Bill, I've only got so much money in my wallet. But if you're going to ask me how much would you have to pay me to give up air conditioning, I'm not budget constrained at that point. It's going to take a lot more. Then you know, the buying and the selling prices should be different. Don't worry, you're normal if you think that.
Mm-hmm. I also bogged down on the refrigerator question.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up putting a very large dollar figure on it. And I think maybe, again, that's a product of living here in upscale Silicon Valley. I put down my dollar sign, then I went and I looked online at Best Buy to see what refrigerator
for. Because you don't think about it, right?
Yikes. I bought me a Cadillac refrigerator. So you're going to have all this data in front of you, Tim, and what are you looking for with all this information?
Well, one of the things I want to answer is conservatives and liberals actually agree when they complain, you economists don't value things correctly. Now, liberals will say there's no dollar price on environmental quality or civil rights. And conservatives will say, well, there's no dollar figure on police force protection. We don't protect that. And you're not measuring our constitutional rights like freedom of speech and gun rights. They're both correct. Mm-hmm. But what if you did have a dollar price on those? Like, this is where you get really interesting. How much would I have to pay you to give up freedom of speech for a year? And not just for you, for the whole country. We just wouldn't have freedom of speech. If you were to say $1 million, I don't think you're an outlier. I think that's probably, we're not measuring in GDP what real value we have as a society.
Right.
And so I think I'm going to get a final number that is 3, 4, 5 times higher in our society than what GDP is measuring. And that, I hope, will blow people's minds.
Politicians go after this, Tim, but politicians don't say, I'm going to take $2,000 a year out of your pocket. They're going to say, this is going to cost you 20 cents a day.
It'll pay for itself, Bill.
Exactly, exactly. So that's the goal here, to find what people will put a price on.
I think some of our friends on the left have a point. We need to maybe have a way to put a dollar value on the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an honest trade-off, you know, when you're talking about polluting industries. I'm not saying they should go to zero, but we should be able to have an intelligent conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, when people say our country's gone backwards since 1960,
mm-hmm.
or worse, I've had people say we haven't really made any gains in our society since 1910. Brother, women couldn't vote in 1910. I think that's worth something. Mm-hmm. I think we should be able to put a very high dollar value on it and say civil rights, women's rights, gender rights. I think they matter. And I think we can talk about them in economic terms.
You know, we're in an age right now, though, where the Democrats are running against Trump in 2020. They're more than happy to put out very large dollar figures,
yeah.
be it the Green New Deal, forgiving college debt, or so forth. But what's interesting is to see those ideas picked apart. Michael Boskin, our colleague, very esteemed economist, was in here the other week, and we were talking about the Green New Deal. And Mike Boskin had a very interesting approach. It's very tempting to say, my God, look at the cost of this.
Yeah.
We can't afford this. And now you're in the mosh pit of, oh, look how much money the government spends already. So
yeah.
now you want to have a conversation now about belt tightening. Okay,
yeah.
fine.
Yeah.
What Boskin talks about, though, more is feasibility. And in the case of the Green New Deal, he says, okay, fine, let's do this. You have to have 4,000, you know, solar panels, 4,000 houses a day have to have solar panels on them, Buildings America, to keep up the Green Deal. So there are ways to go about this. But I mention this, Tim, because there are politicians right now who are not afraid to throw out big dollar figures at people.
Yeah.
And this strikes me as a very interesting thing psychologically. You open up a newspaper, if you go online and look at the price of anything, it's always rounded down.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody sells you a house for $1 million. It's always $995,000. Nobody sells you a blender for $60. It's $59.90. It's just
cynic.
It's psychologically just trying to think, ooh, I'm getting a deal.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's so true. Well, you know, and the way I'd like to frame this, because Mike's warnings have been ignored by the politicians.
Right.
John Taylor, John Cochran, John Kogan, all the economists. And I've seen Larry Summers, who's not a Hoover colleague of ours, Democratic economist, warn about the deficit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Paul Krugman, when Democrats aren't in power, warns about the deficit. So it's a real concern, and we don't seem to be resonating. But if I were to be able to get people to say, is it worth risking your children's financial future?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you increase the odds of insolvency or an outright bankruptcy of the dollar by 5%, it's just
right.
a risk. We don't know for sure it'll happen. I think people might have that as a trade-off that they would sort of open their eyes to. There may be some way to get free money now, but is it really worth risking their children's future? And there's nothing on the other side of the scale right now. I don't think politicians even talk about revenues. They just talk about the benefits.
That's right.
Well, Elizabeth Warren, let's give her some credit.
Mm-hmm.
She always says we should add a wealth tax, a 2% to 5% wealth tax. Problem is, she uses that for about 20 different programs. So she's only going to be able to pick one. Mm-hmm. The other 19 are not feasible.
Yeah, I think one of the problems here for the political class is when you talk about the evilness of deficits and debts and trillions of dollars, the average person has no idea what $1 trillion is.
Nope.
The average person doesn't really know what $1 billion is, except that a handful of people in America are billionaires, and it must be nice. People know what $1 million is. I'd be very curious in the economic quiz as to what people think wealth is. There was one a survey done here in Palo Alto, I think a year or two ago, Tim, and they asked people to describe their existence. They asked people for their income, and they described how do you see yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the corollary is fascinating. People who are making $300,000 to $400,000 a year put down middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know where you were raised. I know where I was raised. $300,000 where I grew up was not middle class.
Yeah, Yeah, well, and here in Palo Alto, where right. homes cost $2-3 million,
right?
But that makes sense,
right? But it also ties into what your quiz is getting at, which is how people perceive things and ultimately how people perceive themselves. What is wealth in this country?
Yeah.
You know, we're in an age now where people can get to $1 million if yeah. you work hard, you play by the rules, you invest properly, you could be a millionaire.
Well, there are a couple fun thoughts about this. First is we really don't think in dollar terms at all anyway. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about what dollars can buy. We're thinking about the values. What do we really want? Is we want security, right? So right. owning a home, that sense that I could actually own it outright and nobody could take it from me, and we've got a place to stay. Economic security means you could feed your children and that they'll get educated. So, you know, those security and stability things really matter a lot. Mm-hmm. And the big spending programs satisfy a short-term desire, but they come with great long-term risk. And that's something I think that politics doesn't do a good job of balancing. And then the second thing is, I think as I dug into this question and led to this survey, which, let me plug, it's hoover.org/Kane study, K-A-N-E study. Go there, you can participate. But I found out that this question of value goes back to Socrates and Plato. And they didn't figure it out. Adam Smith said, hey, remember the ancient Greeks had this water diamond paradox. How much is a bucket of diamonds worth versus a bucket of water? Well,
right.
if you're in the middle of the desert, the answer may surprise you. He was getting at the hinting at supply and demand. But Adam Smith left out something the ancient Greeks knew, which is they had a poem by a poet named Pindar. It said, water is best. Oh, but gold's even better because it glows and it never loses its luster. Oh, but glory is the most valuable thing of all. Glory in the Olympic Games. It was a poem to honor the very first Olympic Games ever. And I think sometimes we've forgotten that things like glory or human dignity or love of your children, those are worth more than gold or water.
All right. Let's talk about something that is less pleasant than economic beauty contests, and that is one of your fortes here at Hoover, and that is immigration.
Immigration.
Back in the news last week.
Yeah.
An agency that I had not heard of before it came out last week in the news, Tim, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. What is that exactly?
Oh, it's one of the alphabet soup of different agencies. Immigration tends to fall now under Department of Homeland Security,
right.
Where before it stood out. I couldn't tell you where all the dividing lines are.
Mm-hmm.
U.S. Border Patrol, as we all know, patrols the border and is there to keep our border secure against drug traffickers and mm-hmm. sex traffickers, but also illegal immigrants. But once somebody gets into the country, then they get processed immediately over to USCIS. So I think they implement the laws
right.
regarding immigration, including when people apply to become legal immigrants and
right.
making sure they've got the proper papers. Well, the acting director, Ken Cuccinelli, put out a policy alert. This is essentially administrative law. And they said,
right.
the United States has been interpreting the legislation about immigration this one way for decades. We're going to clarify it.
Right.
And it caused a real uproar because what they basically said is, if you're a U.S. government worker
mm-hmm.
or a military member and you're overseas and as a woman, have a child,
right.
or your spouse has a child if you're in the military, no longer will that child be a U.S. citizen. That caused a real uproar, as you can imagine.
He had to go on TV the next day and unexplain it.
they tried to re-clarify,
right.
And I've heard two explanations. One, I haven't heard a quote from him, but it spread around Twitter. That so maybe this was a USCIS clarification, that
mm-hmm.
they only meant adopted children.
Right.
That's not true. I've read this policy alert three times. I don't think the word adopted is even in there. It's full stop. Children of U.S. citizens who are born abroad are no longer automatically given U.S. citizenship. No caveats, no exceptions, no saying, oh, we mean if you'd never lived in the U.S., but you happen to be a U.S. citizen yourself. It just says full stop. Your children are not
so
U.S.
John
citizens.
McCain was born on a submarine base in Panama.
That's right. John McCain was born overseas, but parents were military and happened to be on a U.S. military base. So, you know, you sort of had two bullets right there that they said that counts as U.S. resident. Mm-hmm. Cuccinelli is saying, no, 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 residence means you're residing in the United States.
Okay. Well, here's what the Trump administration is getting at ultimately. And what it wants to do is it wants to change green card criteria. And let me read through a little bit of what's been proposed here, Tim.
Okay.
Let's get your feedback on it. About 544,000 people apply for green cards every year. And about 382,000 of them fall into categories that are be subject to this new review. Under the new rules, in effect, the Department of Homeland Security has redefined a public charge. The phrase, I'm saying public charge, you can explain that in a minute, as someone who is, quote, more likely than not to receive public benefits for more than 12 months within a 36-month period. If someone uses two benefits, that is counted as 2 months. The definition has been broadened to include Medicaid, housing assistance, and food assistance under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP for short. Snappy name, huh? Let's continue. Women who are pregnant and on Medicaid or need public assistance will not be subject to the new rules during pregnancy or for 60 days after giving birth. The Medicare Part D low-income subsidy also won't be considered a public benefit. Benefits received by children under 21 won't be considered. No real emergency medical assistance, school lunch programs, foster care or adoption, student loans and mortgages, food pantries, homeless shelters, or disaster relief. Active U.S. military members are also exempt, as are refugees and asylum seekers. Green card hopefuls will also be required to submit 3 years of federal tax returns. In addition to a history of employment, if immigrants have private health insurance, that will weigh heavily in their favor. Essentially, the Trump administration is making it more difficult to get a green card. What is wrong with this?
I don't know if there's what's wrong with it. And I think it's just a question of, for me, you're talking about more bureaucrats that you have to hire that go through this paperwork, or keep the same number of bureaucrats who just won't go through the paperwork very quickly, and so people will just be caught up in red tape and they won't get their citizenship, or they won't get their green card, we should say properly. And big government in general is frustrating to someone who's got a libertarian mindset. Right. I wanted to go back a little bit, Bill, though, and clarify. For roughly 10 years now, the U.S. has brought in either 1 million LPRs, legal permanent residents, every year. These are people that, you know, can achieve citizenship if they want. They don't always have to. That's the green card. But the numbers you just quoted were a lot lower than that. So off the top of my head, I know most LPRs are granted on a family basis, more than half. And there have been about 100,000 given out to refugees. Quite a few are employment-based, where you'll have an employer sponsor you, or you have a special skill set. And then there are some given out, let's say 50,000 in this diversity lottery. You just said a number that was around 500,000. You said it was going to be...
What I dug up, 544,000 people each year apply for green cards.
Okay, are applying.
And about 382,000 fall into categories that would be subject.
Oh, okay.
Today's review.
Okay. Yeah, so I think if someone's... I think most of these would probably be applying then to the... to the family reunification. Bottom line, though, is they want to make it harder for people to come in who are just coming in to take welfare.
Right.
And I get that. I think most, even the independent polling I've done of American attitudes, that's the one sort of resentment. Not that someone comes in poor, but that they're going to come in and just get welfare and then not work.
Right.
Some of those requirements, I think, though, blur the line between are you taking any welfare benefits and still working? And I think most Americans would agree with me on this, that if someone has a job, it's okay if they're receiving some other public benefits, right? Or there are some on the right who want to say, if your children are even going to school, that's a public benefit. Well, well wait a minute. You know, some of these public goods, we require these children to go to school. But yeah, they're trying to tighten it down a little bit. I'm not so sure on principle that's necessarily a bad thing. I'd want to make sure that the caveat was, if someone has a job, they're not they're never considered a public charge.
Right.
You know, if you're working 40 hours a week, don't worry, you wouldn't lose these benefits. And I think these new rules muddy those waters, and that deserves to be clarified.
Right. But in this Gordian knot that is immigration and immigration reform, this is at the heart of the question, and the heart of the question is who gets to come to the United States of America, who gets in, and who gets in first. And it sounds like these reforms are saying that if you are in any way tied in public assistance, you're not at the front of the line. You're going to go to the back of the line or further back.
Yeah.
And, you know, this gets very complicated.
And it's hard.
We're into Emma Lazarus, and we're into skills-based immigration and so forth, and then the debate rages on.
Yeah, send me your wretched poor, wretched masses is not the guiding principle. And what should concern all Americans is that this becomes a block to people who could potentially be public charges. Mm-hmm. Or say someone comes in as a refugee, very low skilled, but they go right to work.
Right.
And they break their leg.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not their fault. The guy they were working with on a construction site dropped something. You know, do you retroactively take away green cards then? So I think we have a rich country based on accepting in a lot of refugees. And the public charge initially was pretty easily applied to someone who had an incurable disease, mm-hmm. or they were very old and infirm. I mean, there was some screening that went on. People were turned back at Ellis Island 100 years ago because they were clearly going to become public charges. This just seems to me to be a very bureaucratic extension and maybe not one that aligns with our values.
Who gets top priority right now?
Well, I think in general, top priority is scientists and engineers do have there are special categories for them.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there are some real limits placed on a country-by-country basis. So no country can have more than a certain percentage, whether it's China or, you know, this tiniest Bahamian island. And that doesn't make a lot of sense. So maybe that should be proportionalized. But if you're a scientist from a small country and you want to be a U.S. citizen, you probably have a really good shot.
Mm-hmm. Should immigration, Tim, be skills-based or humanitarian-based?
Oh, I think it should be a mix here. And I really...
Can you do both?
Absolutely. Now, a lot of people have liked this phrase that the president has promoted called merit-based immigration.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I like merit-based immigration, but not at the expense of all family or getting rid of the diversity lottery. Why? Mm-hmm. One of the great things about America is it's the one country in the world where so many other people want to move here that we have to have a lottery just so that everyone has a fair shot.
Right.
And I've met lottery winners. I met a man from Iran he and his wife had two daughters, and they didn't want Sharia law to govern who their daughters got to marry. This is a Muslim who didn't want to live in a country governed by Sharia law. This was his refuge. He could only get here through the diversity lottery. He's so happy to be here. He's a very patriotic American. I don't want to give that up. But let me ask another question to you, Bill, is mm-hmm. what's the real fear of terrorism, do you think? When the middle American is told to be afraid of immigrants, why?
Why?
Yeah.
The fear of terrorism.
Yeah. Or no, sorry, I said terrorism. Maybe I gave it away. Yes.
Yeah. No. It's the fear. It's severalfold. It's the fear that people are coming to the United States of America, they don't blend into America culturally. They don't understand American freedom.
Yep.
They don't blend in terms of diversity. They want to maintain old traditions.
They feel alienated.
They create their own little pockets to live in, and that creates a certain bitterness, a backlash, if you will, and out of that, bad things happen.
So what worries me is if we shift away from family-based immigration, which mm-hmm. America is unique in the world.
Right.
I don't think there's any other country that brings in more than 30% of their migrants through family basis. We bring in over two-thirds, okay? Mm-hmm. But what if someone comes in with a master's degree and they've got merit, but they don't find a job?
Right.
And they don't have any family here? Then you talk about alienation, right? Family-based reunification or family-based migration means people are integrating and assimilating faster. They know where to get a job. They know where the bank is, how to open a bank account.
Right.
They've got a church community they're part of, most likely, aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews. They understand that all their family are Americans. They love their family. They love America. We have something really special here that maybe the rest of the world should be copying us in terms of family basis. So, yeah, let's lean a little bit more into merit. Let's stop kicking out people with a degree from Caltech just because they were born in India.
Right.
But, no, let's not scrap what's already working.
So in the course of research this podcast, Tim, I came across an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times of October the 20th of 2014. The headline, "There's a Better Way to Do Immigration Reform." And
who
wrote this nonsense? The author of this piece said that he talked to 40 scholars, both the left and the right, about immigration, asked for the recommendations. Four things came out of it. Number one, there was a strong consensus among these scholars for eliminating the cap on non-agricultural H-2 visas, which cover seasonal jobs such as food servers, landscape. Second point, make E-Verify program mandatory so that only legal workers could be hired. A third point, unlimited visas for high-skilled STEM workers.
Mm-hmm.
And a fourth point, there should be a portability when it comes to visas to allow workers to change employees.
Right.
Okay, so that's October the 20th of 2014. The five-year anniversary of that op-ed will be next month, Tim. Of those four things that I've mentioned, how many of them are now law?
I I don't think any of them are law.
How many of them have made it to the floor of the House or the Senate, do you think?
You know, there was a bill in the House. They had two bills with some immigration reforms in them. And this was the Paul Ryan-led effort that ended up failing because not even the Republican caucus could agree among themselves to pass a bill. We're very far away from bipartisan reform. I couldn't tell you which of those pieces were in those legislation. I mean, I think you could see from pretty far away that whole effort was going to crash. And the frustrating thing is, Bill, partisans have taken over the process, and they would rather fight about this. So even when you do see these massive comprehensive bills, they're kind of designed to fail. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, what's something simple that we could agree on? And I will give President Trump credit where he's tried to offer some compromises and saying, hey, fund my wall and let's, you know, as a trade-off, I forget what the last one he offered was, you know, we could lock in a certain amount of refugees per year. And the Democrats, when they've decided that the wall was, in Nancy Pelosi's words, immoral, then there's no way you can compromise on it.
Right. You mentioned before we came on the air that senators come out here periodically. You talk to members of Congress about immigration. What do they want to know about? And isn't it tempting just to push back and say, something?
I've had some really good talks with staffers at the congressional level. Mm-hmm. And I think what I would say that might surprise listeners is I've thought about this issue for so long. I still feel like one of the hardest things to solve is the 11 million illegals in the shadows, right? The illegal immigrants that are here. Undocumented, whatever you want to say. And they've been here for a long time. You know, mostly they 20, 30 years, and they've got homes and families and all that. And the staffers are all like, Dr. Kane, that's so 5 years ago. That's not – nobody cares about that now. We care about children in cages and the caravans storming the gate. So it's sort of the issue du jour is what drives politicians because if it's on Fox News and MSNBC's mad about it, then they're agitated and they want to, if not solve it – at least be talking about it. So, yeah, I think the asylees, the wave of asylees, and I think, again, Trump was right to call this crisis at the border of Central American migrants. That's really first and foremost on minds, not to solve them, but to make hay about them, partisan hay, one way or the other.
But is anybody in Congress thinking about the 11 million, the legalization debate? And I know this gets ugly very fast because we get in these buzzwords like pathway and amnesty.
Yeah. No, I really think that's pretty far on the back burner. I think some staffers have, you know, legislative language from 10 failed efforts in the past they can roll out again. Mm-hmm. But the issue now was first Democrats were denying there was a crisis at the border when there clearly was one.
Right.
And then they flipped it around to why are you having all these people, you know, there's not enough space for them. And, you know, like imagine the Trump administration going, exactly, there's not enough space. We need funding. We also, frankly, need to revise what we call pull factors. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side, the Dems want to say, oh, it's all push factors. Honduras is so violent. Violence in Honduras peaked 7 years ago. It's been coming down.
Right.
Incomes per capita have been rising for the last decade in Honduras. It's not push factors, I don't think. I don't buy it at all. Mm-hmm. It's the sense that you can get a de facto amnesty. You jump over, say, I'm seeking asylum. Look, I've got a child with me. That creates a lot of perverse incentives for people to steal children, to take children in very dangerous areas.
Right.
I think Trump's right. We need to really build up, if not a physical wall, than an administrative wall that says you can't just have asylum because you come here with a little kid.
Yeah. I think a couple of verbs are worth noting here. One is to be Obama'd, and the other one's to be Rubio'd.
Okay.
And to be Obama'd is to have presidential ambitions and to be faced with a chance to actually vote on immigration reform, but then suddenly discover that organized labor doesn't like what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you fold because you need organized labor. To be Rubio'd is to be seen as wanting to compromise on immigration and paying a heavy price with your party's base.
Yeah. Yeah, Rubio got schnookered, right? Yes. With the Gang of Seven, I think, was his.
The gang, right.
And they said, sign on to this comprehensive. It was almost like Charlie Brown and Lucy in the football. Come on, we're going to do comprehensive immigration reform.
Yes.
You take a kick at it this time, Senator Rubio. And, you know, and then they pulled it away and he had to flip-flop about what he stood for. Yeah, I think comprehensive is a trick for the gullible young senator. Mm-hmm. If you're a smart senator, I think what you want to do is put together a very tightly focused reform. And can I tell you what my proposal is, Bill?
Go ahead.
I wouldn't accept any refugees as the United States from any country unless that country had been designated as a refugee country by the president. I think we should have a really generous refugee policy for people fleeing civil war in Syria, where there are massacres and chemical weapons, or in Venezuela, where you have a flat-out communist meltdown. Venezuela, Syria, the Ukraine, hey, maybe China, where they're putting people in re-education camps by the millions. Those four countries, refugees from there, yes. But I'm sorry, no, if you're getting economic aid and your economy is just relatively poor, that's really abusing the definition of what an asylee or a refugee is. That's hard-hearted, but it also means people aren't going to be trekking children across the desert by coyotes that are going to then die and drown in the Rio Grande. That, to me, is inhumane.
Right. The Charlie Brown analogy is a good one. What also comes to mind, Tim, is the old gag of any volunteers step forward. Everybody steps back. Whoever doesn't move back, volunteers. Who is going to step forward and do this? Because if you look at the lineup in Washington right now, I don't see, unless Donald Trump is reelected and he faces an all-Democratic Congress in a second term and just decides, as sometimes second-term presidents do, I got to do some dealing, I got a legacy, and he got to be brought around this. He's willing to cut a deal. It's hard to see, as long as Trump's in office, Democrats and Congress going along with the deal. If a Democrat's elected president, it's hard to see Republicans, if they say hold on to the Senate in after the 2020 election, it's hard to see them working with the freshman president. So what's going to change here?
I think the second term Obama Trump presidency, if there's a changing of the people that work for the president, I think President Trump wants to make a deal, but I don't think his staffers, the important, powerful ones, are. I'm talking, I'm gonna blank on his name. Used to be Steve Bannon. Anyway, those people don't want a deal. They're playing politics with this issue. So I also think Pelosi right now
is Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller.
Yes.
I don't think Nancy Pelosi is very sincere about wanting a deal, or maybe she's afraid of her base. That's the AOCs that are so stuck on.
Okay, so let's take this in a different direction then, Tim. What did Barack Obama say in his second term after he lost the Senate and had no control of Congress? I still have a pen and I still have a phone.
Yeah.
What could Donald Trump do in the way of executive authority right
Well,
now?
Well, he's already been pushing the pen and the phone pretty aggressively. This recent policy alert from USCIS is an example of trying to kind of pick a fight over what birthright citizenship means.
Yes.
But I think, to quote Jack Nicholson, he picked a fight with the wrong Marine, right? So, but he's been very proactive with his pen and phone already. But it's not long-term, and America's just so hungry for a long-term compromise.
Yes.
Americans want to compromise in this. We want to maintain our world leadership as the number one destination for migrants. We want every Chinese scientist to move here so we can win the coming rivalry with China.
Right.
But, we're tired of the squabbling, and I just don't think until you get some different people that we can see the best President Trump that we could possibly see.
Yeah, I just don't know what the long-term solution, Tim, is if you don't go after the core of the matter, which is 11 million people in this country who are living in this kind of netherland where they're here. They are not legally persecuted. They're not hunted down by law enforcement. They live in society, but they don't have full access to everything in society. They kind of have one foot in, but one foot not in at the same time.
Yep. Yeah, that is the easiest problem to solve. And you just look at some opinion polling on it, because a majority of Republicans do not want to deport those 11 million folks here.
Right.
And a majority of Democrats don't think they deserve to cut in the line for citizenship, which is a euphemistically called pathway. No special pathway. Democrats don't want that. Republicans don't want deportation. What they agree on is we'll give them legal status. They can't get welfare. They can't vote. But if they're here and they want to keep working, let them out of the shadows. Fine. Let them pay taxes, right? Let them be a part of our society. Legal status, Bill. We have, you said 11 million illegal immigrants in the country. It's 181 million foreigners visit America every year. They go to Disneyland. They cut business deals. They invest. That's legal status. So just call them, guests, legal status, workers, and be done with the controversy. That's what the American people want.
Final question for you, Tim. You ran for Congress.
I've heard that, yeah.
You are eligible to run for president because you are born in the United States of America and you are over the age of 35. Your lovely wife could run for Congress.
Oh, yeah, she could.
Your lovely wife cannot run for president.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, Hiromi was born in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she can't be president. Neither could Alexander Hamilton, right?
Right.
So you can still contribute greatly to this society.
So here's a thought. I want to get your thoughts on this as we close out. Why isn't immigration reform also throwing... We hear a lot of talk about trying to change birthright citizenship. Why isn't anybody going to looking at presidential requirements? We're in California, Tim. There are a lot of remarkable people who live in California who came from Vietnam in the 1970s when they're 6 years old, a year old. They're probably more passionate about freedom and liberty than you and I are.
Yeah.
So happy to be here. These would be wonderful people to run the country. Under the Constitution, they are not eligible to run for the presidency. Why isn't it changed?
I think because secretly, almost every American thinks they could become president, and they just don't want any more competition. And you know, I remember being in grad school studying my econ PhD, and there were four American citizens in that class, and there were about 16 foreign born, and most of them went back to Germany or Portugal and became brilliant professors, or Italy, and a lot of them stayed here though. But I'll tell you what, you could tell who the four dumbest people in that class were, right? We do attract the best and the brightest. It's one of the great things in our country. And I remember Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was, I thought, a pretty darn good governor. And I liked the fact that I liked the message he ran on. There was a movement to amend the law so that Arnold Schwarzenegger could run for the presidency.
I was in on that.
Yeah.
And at actually, so it was called Amend for Arnold.
Yeah.
Which was really a terrible. I did not care for the title of it, and I pushed against it. I lost that argument because my contention was that, look, somewhat of Arnold Schwarzenegger's profile, Arnold Schwarzenegger came to the United States of America in his 20s.
Yeah.
In love with America since he was a little boy, just had passion for the United States and freedom and, be a weightlifter and be an entrepreneur and all that. He loved America, studied, became a citizen, really did. But Arnold could be governor of California, he could run for Congress, but he could not be president because he was not a natural born citizen. Why not amend the Constitution so someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Gerhard Casper, the president of Stanford, former president of Stanford, remarkable individuals could be president of the United States? Instead, the Constitution, because we created a republic that we lived in the fear of European monarchs dominating us, and so we couldn't have anybody foreign born as president. Why not update the Constitution?
Yeah, I just wanted to see him get reelected because we know his slogan would be
right. But the mistake with the Arnold, because Arnold's name was on it, it looked like a front for trying to get Arnold elected president. If you did the math on it and figured how long it would take to actually get a constitutional amendment done, sometimes it's done lickety split. Oftentimes they drag out. Arnold would have been past his prime. But to me, always the symbol was the Vietnamese boat person who came here with Vietnam, just a faint memory, if at all, but loving the United States of America.
There's a photo of a friend of mine who was a West Point cadet and came to America as a two-year-old refugee, poor refugee.
Right.
And went on to serve, has created companies here, employed hundreds of Americans, fought in Afghanistan, even after he left the army, then the wars in the Middle East. And he, even though he was at a very senior position, he thought, I still want to give back.
And
I thought about putting the photo of him in his West Point uniform when he was a cadet, and he visited the Vietnam Memorial and saluted all those men and women who'd fought and died for him. It's a really powerful story about how profound the patriotism of the foreign-born American is.
Yeah, I just recognize the fallacy of my argument. Under my plan, Justin Bieber could be president of the United States.
No, we've got to have our limits.
There goes that amendment. What to look for next on the immigration front?
Well, it will certainly feature in the presidential election. I think what we want to watch in the very short term is how much is immigration discussed when you get down to the last two or three Democratic nominees or candidates for the nomination. Because I'd like it to be something that the Democrats emphasize. I think it's a potential winner for them, but they can overplay their hand badly and lose the election.
It hasn't been much of a presence in the debate so far.
I haven't felt it myself. Yeah. It was 4 years ago during the Republican debates, and I wrote a few articles about it. And they were substantive. I mean, they were really, really fascinating debates where Republicans were displaying of many different policy preferences.
Right.
And Donald was coming across saying, I like immigrants at certain times, right? I mean, there was a populist message, but he was also, you couldn't tell where the policy would land. With this crowd, what I've seen is the Democratic candidates for president in 2020 are getting pulled to the far left on a host of issues.
Right.
And so it's essentially an open borders argument. middle America does not want open borders. They don't think that's fair.
Right, but these candidates also play into the crowd, Tim. Our colleague Doug Rivers, who does polling, you worked with him, he does polling for YouGov and The Economist, The New York Times, CBS News. YouGov did a survey recently, asked Democrats and Republicans, what matters to you? Very interesting. Democrats, it's health care.
Yeah.
It's a bread and butter issue. And Republicans, it's immigration.
Yeah.
And this is the Trump effect on the Republican Party.
Yeah,
He's been banging the drum on immigration since he came down from the elevator in 2015, and it resonates now.
I you can tell. Anyone who's listened this far into our interview knows I have a complex outlook. I think immigration's put power in the superpower of America, and I care most of all about keeping America strong. At the same time, it makes me really frustrated when people abuse our laws and when it kills children. So I think this asylee crisis, this refugee crisis at the border, is something the Democrats have been incredibly unserious about. And it actually, you know, I'm an economist, but I get angry, and I get angry about that. So, the Democrats, I think, are going to mishandle this. And that's what I'm looking for. That's really what's the next big issue? It's how far left do the Democrats go? And if they keep going left on immigration, they're going to keep bringing out the vote for Donald Trump.
So final question, so there are 10 Democrats debating a week from now in Houston, Texas. And I look at that field, Tim, right now, and there are really 5 Democrats to pay attention to. If you just look at the polling, if you just look at the path to the nomination, that's Joe Biden, it's Bernie Sanders, it's Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and to a lesser extent, Pete Buttigieg.
Mm-hmm.
The other 5 are just kind of way down in the polls, and they're just going to...
Can I give you my favorite insight on how not to run a campaign?
Yeah, go ahead.
Was somebody told Beto O'Rourke, who a lot of us thought might become the nominee,
yes,
strike while the iron's cold. He waited too long.
And do an Instagram video of you mouth open to the dentist. I reckon that wouldn't play well in Ohio, would it?
So of those 5, who are you putting your chips on?
I'm not going to go that far, but my question to you, since it's my podcast and I put you on the spot instead, I'm interested in what Joe Biden's going to do in immigration.
Yeah.
Because Biden is the only one of those 5 who is really thinking 270 electoral votes.
Yeah.
And is thinking, what do I have to do like Bill Clinton did to win back blue-collar voters?
And people may be angry about him. I thought he's crazy like a fox, where he says things that seem a little politically incorrect. There are a lot of Democrats, old school Scranton, Pennsylvania Democrats, right, that get tired of the shrieking far left political correctness crowd. I think he might have a really solid grip on the Reagan Democrats and understanding, look, we need some law and order along with embracing immigration. So,
but he has a problem in that first debate that he was a part of, the question was asked, would you give health benefits to non-citizens? And a lot of hands shot up in the air, and Joe's hand kind of climbed reluctantly. He could see the hamster in the cage spinning, thinking, what do I do? But the hand went up. So, again, as he's looking at middle America, Tim, your Ohio and other states, where do you think he's going to come down on immigration? Because you're right, he can't be an open borders guy.
No, I don't think he will be. In fact, I think as the field narrows, he may solidify his centrist credentials and try to look. When you're in a race like this and everyone else is trying to go to the left, you feel a lot of pressure.
Right.
But the first one that can break out smartly and seize the center, there are a lot of votes just among Democrats that are centrists and don't want open borders. They don't want to see images on TV of people scaling the wall. They think a wall makes sense. Mm-hmm. And they still want to have a lot of refugees that are allowed here from places where they're fleeing persecution. You know, Jews being gassed in Nazi Germany comes to mind. That's a refugee, not just America's rich country and I want to be there. I think Biden's going to play that up. And he'll even hint at arguments that I think are economically incorrect, but we need to secure American jobs for Americans first.
We have a third microphone here, and I wish that Bill Clinton was behind that microphone right now
because
Clinton's a complicated guy on a lot of levels. There are a lot of things about his presidency that were exasperating, and I found it exasperating as a candidate when he said that he smoked, he tried it, but he didn't inhale. And
talk about triangulating. Yeah.
Certain things he did as a president, signing the Federal Defense of Marriage Act in the dead of night without any cameras around, just kind of raised a question of core convictions. But the man was a genius when it came to triangulation and kind of understanding where to be in the middle of things. I would love to hear Bill Clinton's thoughts on where to be in the middle of immigration.
Yeah. No, he was a very smart guy, and you know what? He liked free trade. So I'm going to just tip my hat to Bill Clinton. He did some really good things on the economy.
Okay. Tim Kaine, enjoy the conversation.
Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy choices confronting America's 45th president. If you liked what you heard, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, as you can as well a whole host of Hoover podcasts. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, I encourage you to sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which sends the best work of Hoover's fellows, including Dr. Timothy Kaine, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution is on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover INST. Tim Kaine's also on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Timmer Kaine. I got that right.
You did?
Right? Yeah, it's TimmerKaine, at Timmer Kaine. And his economic beauty contest, Tim, you want to give the plug for it one last time? Where can you find it?
Hoover.org/KaineStudy.
And you have until midnight on Monday the 9th to get in your questions, to get in your answers. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.